Welcome to the Daily Briefing. I'm Jack Farley. It is Wednesday, September 8th. Today, I am joined by Darius Dale of 42 Macro. Darius, welcome back to Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
I'm feeling fantastic, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. We had a pre-interview today where we were just going at it, talking macro. It lasted, you know, probably 35 minutes, and I cannot wait to show the people at home what's on your radar. Darius, I want to start off by noting that a lot of bearish research reports have been coming out of the big banks, whether it's Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, or Goldman Sachs. And they are noting, I'd say, three risks. The first risk is the Delta virus. Second risk is slowing economic growth or you know, the peaking of economic growth. And the third is balance sheet tapering by global central banks, most notably the Federal Reserve. You, reading your report from 42 Macro, it seems like you're not joining in this chorus of being bearish. You still see a lot of upside in the equity market in being risk on. Tell us why.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll tell you why we're bullish. Let me start with where you started, which is where the banks. So number one, Delta. If you look at East Asia, some of the survey data coming out of Korea, that's likely peaked, and we're on the other side of the peak economic impact of Delta. Number two, why does Wall Street ever get bearish? It's valuation and it's their surveys. I have no comment on the surveys, but valuation is not a catalyst over the near to medium term. And then lastly, I forget what the other thing was.
Tapering.
We don't expect the Fed to commence actual tapering. And I feel like I have to underline or all caps actual every time I say it or write it in a report. It's like, we can talk about tapering for 6 months and all you, if you're bearish because of that, you're just going to watch the stock market grind higher and they'll actually do something. And there, it's been our view that the Fed's unlikely to commence actual tapering until December.
Yeah, I was reading a report in the Financial Times today, and it said, Fed member Bullard reached out to the Financial Times to talk about why we need to taper. And it's so easy to get something mixed up with one member reached out to the media and talked about it with actual tapering itself. So walk us through the timeline for tapering. And then how do you think it will have an impact on risk assets? We were talking earlier, you know, I said, do you think it will impact cyclicals more than tech?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me walk you through the timeline for tapering. And if you allow me to unpack this, part of the reason we have this view that it's going to be December and increasingly likely going to be December is really just a function of the lack of substantial further progress in the labor market. There's quite a few data points that we're tracking on a month-to-month basis that are separate and apart from the headline figures that everyone observes. And if you allow me to sort of kind of go through them, when you look at the employment to population ratio, that ticked up 10 basis points to 58.5 in August, but that's still down 260 basis points from where it peaked in February of last year. Number two, you look at the labor force participation rate for prime working age adults, that's unchanged at 81.8% in August. That's still down 120 basis points from last February. You look at the sort of the total number of people who are out of work as a function of the pandemic. You got an additional 2.7 million people unemployed through August. The labor force, the size of the labor force has declined minus 5.6 million since it peaked last year. So you had about 8.3 million people who were still like physically out of work or out of the labor force altogether as a function of the pandemic. And then when you talk about the Fed sort of, you know, revised dual mandate, specifically the maximum and inclusive sort of portion of that, you know, you're seeing some real interesting dynamics that might actually delay the delayed tapering. So you look at something like the white unemployment rate in August ticked down by 30 basis points to 4.5%. I mean, if you're white, this is a very tight labor market. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But then you look at the Hispanic unemployment rate, that ticked down as well, but it's still elevated at 6.4%. But then you look at the Black unemployment rate, my folks, you know, we're at plus 60 basis points in August, up to 8.8%. So that's still up 360 basis points from where it peaked in August of 2019. So you're starting to see some incremental bifurcation in the labor market that is sort of moving the Fed actually further away from their dual mandate. So to me, I think the real discussion is, what in the hell is Bullard smoking? I mean, is he auditioning to become the next head of the ECB? Is he trying to channel his inner Trichet and tight monetary policy right into a slowdown? I mean, that's what it sounds like. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. You mentioned the different unemployment rates but between different cohorts. Correct me if I'm wrong, but historically, the Federal Reserve only looked at the unemployment rate for the aggregate of all people. Now, the fact that there's a discrepancy and that one cohort or other cohorts are lagging, they view that as a problem, and that, you know, that is factored into the central bank response function. So it would be likely to slow them down in their tapering, right?
Yeah, no, look, I said this last November, man, the most bullish thing for asset markets is the Fed trying to fix racism with monetary policy. Like, they're not going to succeed, obviously, but they're going to try. And look where we are now.
Yeah, yeah. You talked about Bullard, and you talked about him being too soon to taper. I have a theory I want to run by you, Darius, which is that Bullard, he probably believes what he says. He's not, making a misstatement about his own beliefs.
He's the economist. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But he is serving the purposes of the Federal Reserve in that the people who go out and talk to the media, they sound really hawkish and they, you know, say, oh, well, you know, this is ridiculous. We have to taper. And that calms the bond market down because it gives the appearance that the Federal Reserve still cares about, you know, preserving the purchasing power of the dollar, and that they are, you know, I don't want to get too extreme, but, you know, I think that the people who really have their hand on the throttle, they have made it clear that they care about the labor market and that mandate over the inflation mandate. So what do you think about my theory that Bullard and the other hawks serve a role of calming the bond market down? Because if the bond market were to truly grapple, you know, and look into the heart of the Federal Reserve, they would see, hey, it's probably not, you know, good to own a 30-year treasury at 1.9% when the Federal Reserve is okay with inflation running super hot.
Yeah, no, I do believe that, you know, particularly the non-voters in any given year, especially those that are about to sort of join the voting board as Bullard and I believe Bostic are next year, they tend to be the sort of mouthpieces of dissent. And it's sort of, part of it, I think, is them gathering market intelligence, but it's also part of it's like, yeah, to your point, they're trying to sort of put, you know, bumpers around this sort of, it's trying to narrow the range of probable outcomes for both asset markets and the economy. So, you know, I commend him for doing what he's sort of probably been tasked to do. I just don't think it's as urgent as they're sort of implying. I mean, I guess at the top of the CPI chart, you're like, oh my God, inflation, inflation, inflation. And, but nobody's looking at the top of the CPI chart and looking down and said, how did we get here? Well, we got here with record demands, you know, that's been fueled by one-time stimulus and, you know, sort of one partial one-time reopening. We're going to repeat those two dynamics, you know, every month going forward. So inflation is obviously very, very much transitory, if only because the base effects will get more difficult and you're going to lose those two meaningful sort of drivers of demand.
Darius, I want to ask you a question, which is the models that you have at 42 Macro. 2 months ago, they were showing a rising deflationary risk. You know, it wasn't the dominant probability, but it was a high probability relative to now. Now, in your report today, it seems like Goldilocks is the dominant regime. So my question for you is, what has changed? What was signaling a deflationary signal a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, that now is giving you the green light?
Yeah, that's an outstanding question. So I'll preface this by saying we've always thought that we're going to survive this sort of period between the transition from reflation to the actual deflation that we expect to commence sometime, you know, November, December of this year with Goldilocks. We thought Goldilocks would really sort of dominate that path. And part of the reason for that is that the economy in both growth and inflation terms, if you think about the delta, the rate of change of growth and inflation, it's not slowing. Neither of those factors are slowing fast enough to perpetuate a negative market outcome. And so what I mean by that means the onus is shifting from economic signals to policy and positioning signals in terms of sort of driving inter and intra asset class dispersion. And so if that's the situation, let's have a talk about what policies and what positioning are. In terms of, like, you know, with policy, it's like we're already in the middle of a net liquidity tsunami. We've been really enjoying one all year, a bath really. You look at, you know, sort of you. So in terms of how we calculate net liquidity, because there's obviously a million different ways of calculating it, but we look at the change in the Fed's balance sheet minus the change in the Treasury's general account, the cash balance of the Treasury. And that figure is down, you know, 2.3, that figure is up. Like, the net liquidity that's been pumped into asset markets is up 2.3 trillion year to date. It's up 860 billion since the end of June alone. And so that dynamic, that net liquidity dynamic is here to stay, at least over the next kind of, let's call it 2 months.
Darius, correct me if I'm wrong. So in that equation, the addition to the net change in the Fed's balance sheet minus the change in the Treasury General Account, the TGA, hasn't the change in the TGA been negative? So minus a negative and you get a positive.
You're a math guy too, bud.
Negative one times negative one. That's probably the limits of my knowledge. You go a lot further. And actually, let's put your math skills on display. If we could put this chart up right now, I mean, very lucky that people at Real Vision get to watch this and really see into your research. The dots are different ETFs. So ARKK is the ARK growth ETF. Let's see, XLE is the energy. XLU is utilities. GLD is a ETF that owns physical gold. And they're sort of all over the map here, mapped on a Y-axis and an X-axis. Darius, can you explain what the X-axis and Y-axis is? You know, without getting too much, get into the weeds, but don't get lost into the weeds. Just give us the broad picture of what they mean.
Yeah, no, so I get accused once a day of being too verbose and jargony. So my post-Labor Day resolution is to be simplify the complex a bit more. So the key takeaway from this chart is that when you're up to the top left, it usually means that investors are overpaying for protection in the options market. Therefore, the dealer hedging activity that takes place from a delta hedging perspective tends to get unwound and perpetuate moves higher in asset markets. And so that's kind of where we've been all summers, which is why it's one of the many indicators that we're tracking at 42 Macro that suggests that investor consensus positioning across the buy side is not particularly bearish. I mean, there's a myriad of other things that we're looking at. You know, we have a feature called total confirming asset market VAMS, or VAMS are short for volatility adjusted momentum signals. That's in the 72nd percentile of this morning. You typically want to raise red flags if you're either in a Goldilocks or reflation regime, and that's in the 99th percentile, because that means that everyone's kind of, you know, sort of max long risk in that juncture. The last thing we have, we call it our cross asset correction risk indicator. That's CACRI for short, and that's at 40%. And that 40%, typically that number, that time series is typically in the low 20s, high teens, right before meaningful correction in asset markets. So we have some ways to go in terms of investors really putting on risk. And if they don't put on risk, then guess what? You know, it's likely that outside of, you know, your 3-5% corrections, the market's just going to grind higher every day up until the time where the net liquidity provision really starts to get hairy later this year.
Yeah. So a lot of that went over my head, but let's keep that chart on. And the bottom left quad is really sort of the quad of demise for assets. That's when a lot of people are invested. They already own the assets, so there's not a ton of additional liquidity that can buy it. And also, put volatility is high or put volatility is low.
Well, that's when they take off their hedges. The bottom left, you know, part of this chart here is you have a low level of realized volatility as denoted by the x-axis, and you have a negative implied volatility risk premium. And so that means people are unwilling to pay for protection, even though the assets themselves haven't even corrected. And so that to me is like a really negative setup. That is a really negative setup. That's precisely what we saw in the second week of February last year. Like, we had grinded through this wall of worry from November through the mid-February, from November 2019 all the way through February of this year. And I would suspect that that's probably what we're headed for, you know, later this year. Maybe a lot of those dots, if we're having this conversation, you know, 2 months from now, 2.5 months from now, have really gravitated towards the bottom left. And that to me is a real negative signal, because it will likely line up with a lot of other, you know, sort of confirming evidence that investors have really kind of taken off their hedges.
But we're not there yet, right?
No, not there.
Yeah, because in the bottom left quad, there are none of the dots there. All right.
If your viewers learn one thing from me from terms of looking at this particular chart, it's that markets don't crash when everybody's positioned for them. They crash when investors are forced to take off their hedges, either by a low level of realized volatility, they get squeezed out of position, squeezed out of shorts, or they just turn fundamentally bullish. Either or that's the key takeaway.
Darius, thank you for that. I think that, just to give my interpretation of it, so implied volatility is what the market is paying for, whether it will move a lot, and then realizes whether it actually happens. So when implied volatility is higher than realized volatility, the market's buying a lot of insurance, and when people buy insurance, it's hard to be left naked when the tide goes out, right?
Yeah. So the technical linkage is that the dealers who sell the insurance have to then go delta hedge the underlying exposure in the market, you know, so that they're, you know, not, you know, taking on basis risk. And to the extent that the thing that the insurance is being protected against doesn't occur, then they have to cover those hedges. So that's why this analysis is helpful. You know, again, there's not always a signal. but sometimes there is a signal. And when you look at this chart in aggregate, you can pretty much clearly see that the market has been and continues to climb a wall of worry throughout this sort of Goldilocks regime.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, Darius, we have a lot of questions from the audience that are asking now, both on realvision.com and on YouTube. But we're actually going to ask, we're going to take questions first from the Real Vision Exchange. Darius, you posted a great series of charts on the Real Vision Exchange. I believe the link to it is in the description of this video. And you said post your questions. And some Real Vision members, some members of the Hive Mind, they took you up and they have some questions for you. Peter wants to know, what's it going to take for the reflation trade to come back? Are industrial metals signaling something that the rest of the market isn't picking up on?
Probably not. Obviously, you know, so the thing about commodities and thing about any particular commodity or any particular stock or any particular credit is that they can and will move on their own fundamentals. When you're talking about macro, it's about categories of stocks, categories of credits, categories of commodities all moving in unison or all having, you know, some sort of, you know, sort of fractalized dispersion that makes sense from an economic perspective. And so when you talk about like, what will it take for reflation to come back? I think reflation in the economy. And the reality is we've sort of lost those impulses. Part of the reason, two of the reasons we lost impulses, one, we can't just keep reopening indefinitely. And two, we lost a lot of fiscal stimulus. So I do believe the September data are likely to bounce relative to August because August is the peak month of Delta. But the reality is even if the data bounce in September, that's not the start of a new trend. We are now trending lower in growth and in growth terms. And we expect inflation to show a trending deceleration as well by the time you get into September, October. So the reality is if you lack those impulses, and the reason I sort of harp on this is because when you backtest, you know, we have this thing called our grid asset market backtest where we backtest everything that ticks in macro that's relevant through the lens of our grid process. And when you look at those backtests and you study them carefully, you tend to only have meaningful increases in bond yields or meaningful declines in bond prices when the economy is in reflation, i.e. both growth and inflation are accelerating simultaneously. And that's just unlikely to occur on a trending basis throughout the second half of this year and into the early part of next year. So could you get a backup in bond yields? I certainly think that's likely. And part of the reason I think that's likely is when you get into, you know, the later part of Q4, let's say starting in mid-November, certainly by December, you're going to have two things that will be very unfavorable from a technical perspective for the bond market. Now shifting from what's happening in the economy to what's happening technically, and you're going to have the Fed pull back on the amount of stimulus that it's buying, and you're also going to have the Treasury meaningfully accelerate the amount of Treasury issuance, and the reason that's an obvious negative technical for the bond market, and so the reason for that being is because the Treasury market sits at the very top of the global capital structure. Like if you think about this in like schoolyard terms, like the Treasury is 12-year-old Darius is 300 pounds and everybody else is 80 pounds, right? You know, like that is the Treasury market. And so it always gets its money and it's going to get its money from somewhere and it's always going to collect. So you have three options. You and I can sell assets from our portfolios to capitalize them. The foreign central banks, the foreign official reserve sector can capitalize them, or the Fed can capitalize them. Well, we know the foreign reserve sector has not capitalized them in recent years. That peaked in 2014. They refuse to recycle dollars. We know the Fed is likely to be buying, you know, less bonds than they are currently in that time period as well. So that means you and I are going to be forced to capitalize them, capitalize the bully. The bully is going to grab us by the ankles and start shaking us and say, hey, I need hundreds of billions of dollars from you, and I haven't come to collect in a while. And that to me is a negative technical that, you know, could easily see a 10, 15, 20 basis point backup in bond yields, if not a 20 to 30 basis point backup. But this concept of going from 130 to 2 to me still seems somewhat preposterous in the context of lacking all those economic fundamentals that I highlighted earlier.
Yeah, it's such a brilliant analogy you say, Darius. So the Treasury is the bully in middle school who's going around the lunchroom and shaking people, shaking fellow classmates to get some change, hoping the change will fall out of the pockets. Mm-hmm. And the Federal Reserve is the rich kid who says, hey, Mr. Treasury, the Treasury bully, don't worry about it. I'll pay you off. I'll give you the thing. Problem is, if the rich kid stops paying less and less and less, then the bully is going to do a lot of shaking. And you know, some of those kids might not have any much change left to give. Therefore, bonds could go up. So that's the technical thing. But you think that a bond market rout, some weakness in bonds, wouldn't be exacerbated because why?
Well, it would only be exacerbated if the economy were about to show trending acceleration in economic growth and trending acceleration in inflation. It's highly unlikely from a probability perspective that that is occurring, you know, mid to late Q4 of this year. If anything, it'll be extremely obvious that both growth and inflation are trending lower at that point in time.
Right. Two more questions from the Real Vision Exchange. Fred P. wants to know about Darius's views on gold in the coming 3 months. And Jabana wants to know, do you have any thoughts on uranium?
Yeah, gold is in this kind of weird, awkward place, right? Because everything I just said means that you could see a backup in the long end of the TIPS curve. The TIPS are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. That's the real interest rate, you know, deflated by market-based expectations for inflation. And so you could see a backup in the 10-year TIPS yield in that time frame where the bully comes to collect. And between now and then, you could easily see, you know, strength in the U.S. dollar. I just don't see how gold really breaks out of this awkward consolidation phase in any one meaningful way. If anything, I think the risk is probably skewed to the downside, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to go down. My model's neutral on gold from a quantitative perspective in terms of our volatility adjusted momentum signal, and I'm fundamentally neutral on gold as well. And this is another thing. You don't have to have a view on everything ticking at all times. If you have a high conviction view, then express that in your portfolio. My high conviction view is in the process. So the portfolio construction reflects my high conviction in the process, not in any one of those individual securities.
Absolutely. And my long-term view on gold, just based on my research, is quite bullish. But I speak to a lot of smart people and smart analysts, smart investors, who forecast that the next 3 to 6 months for gold could continue to be choppy. So you got to separate the long-term view from the short-term view.
You're spot on, man. So you just hit the nail on the head in terms of what I have these conversations with, you know, with our subscribers and our clients all the time. It's like, we can talk about the destination, but the destination is not how you make or save money. The sequence is how you make or save money. The sequence is where your good and bad decisions occur, or that you compound good decisions or compound negative decisions. And that's what risk management is about. Investing is about telling a story about some future state. Risk management is about not losing money along the way to getting to that future state. And that's what we really focus on here at 42 Macro.
Yeah, Darius, we took a lot of questions from the exchange. The Real Vision Exchange has been around for almost a year now, and a lot of our members get a lot of value to it. We recently took it up a notch in terms of the tech. We launched it on Real Vision 2.0, so it really is a cutting edge platform. And Rao Powell, Real Vision CEO, wanted to let some members just give an update on about the new exchange. So let's take a look at Rao's video that came out today on Real Vision.
I think, you know, by now, I'm passionate about community. I think it's the future of Real Vision, future of business models overall. The community of Real Vision has grown over the years to something truly spectacular, something I call the hive mind. You know, where you get supplied with information from us, and you've become smarter than the individuals on the platform. I mean, we've actually proven it by stuff like the Real Vision bot, which surveys you guys, and you guys are smarter and are outperforming both the market and most of our guests. But over last year, we built out something called The Exchange, which is our kind of social media forum where you can start sharing ideas, videos, research notes, ask the community questions. And the first iteration of that was pretty clunky, and it wasn't perfect. I mean, everybody complained. If you went back, it went all the way back to the beginning of the feed, and the feed was chronological and wasn't sorted by, you know, what was the most engaging content. But we've changed all of that. And we've spent a long time working with the right partner to build out a much better exchange, because I care massively about the hive mind. I think the future of Real Vision lies in this, and that all of our worlds will collapse within the community idea. So now it's nicely organized. It's much cleaner. You can bookmark stuff so you can store some interesting information for later. You can engage with people. There's direct messaging. There's even group messaging, so you can start talking to groups of people yourselves, forming your own networks. And here is where you can post research ideas or ask questions and get proper feedback from people. Now, a lot of you haven't used this yet, but thousands of people are. And I'd really love you to start thinking more and more about how you can use the exchange, because the value of Real Vision is not just the content we make, it's you. You guys are the experts on something. And that's the key thing. When you have lots of experts on something applying their minds to, let's say, finance, markets, crypto, then we've got something truly special. So go in there and enjoy it.
If you want to check out the new and improved version of the exchange, please click in the link for the description below, where you can see all the charts that Darius posted for this exact episode that we talk about in this episode. So thank you, Darius, for posting them. And thank you to the Real Vision Exchange members for posting your questions. Darius, before we get to the other questions on YouTube and realvision.com, of which there are many, I want to quickly put up a chart of your sort of momentum signal for the NASDAQ, QQQ, the NASDAQ 100. And as you can see in the green for the audience, that is a bullish signal. And red is a bearish. And Darius, a lot of the charts that you posted on the exchange, whether it's for low volatility or low beta, communication services, technology, is pretty much, you're bullish on so many things. So you talked about why you're bullish. My question for you is, what are you bearish on?
Yeah, I mean, look, you don't want to be too bearish on too many things if you have a fundamental view of Goldilocks, right? Like that's the starting point. But I do believe that there are pockets of risk out there that are, one has been priced in and we've been, accurate on the, right side of it. And that's China, right? You go back to, the early part of this year when it became very clear, to me at least, that the credit cycle was peaking and rolling over. And we've seen a meaningful sort of decline in that indicator. And the reason I highlight that indicator first is because that tends to be the most the number one thing a lot of investors focus on when they focus on China risk. And so you look at something like the credit impulse that peaked around 32% in November of 2020. That's come down pretty sharply all year. It's just shy of 25% now. And the reason I call that out is because I haven't seen anything from the PBOC or from the Politburo that suggests that we're going to see a meaningful sort of cessation of that decline. So historically you've seen pretty sharp declines in something like 3 month SHIBOR. And the reason I look at 3 month SHIBOR
is what is that 3 month what?
SHIBOR is interbank lending rates in China.
Oh, okay.
So the reason I look at that is because, most people don't realize this, but 4/5 of private non-financial sector credit is on bank balance sheet in China. Like it's sitting on the bank balance sheet. The banks are the primary source of credit intermediation on the mainland, whereas you look at something like the U.S., less than 50% is on bank balance sheet. We have hedge funds, mutual funds, all these other entities, not bank sector, creating credit. And so you look at something like SHIBOR, you're going to get a general sense of the ultimate impact of monetary policy. And you can sort of see it in China in a way that you can't see in many other economies. And SHIBOR has barely budged. It's only down 10 basis points in the last 2 months since the end of June. And so it's telling you that, hey, look, the PBOC's policy setting has not materially eased yet, because you're not seeing it in the interbank lending rates yet. And so that means that the credit impulse in China is unlikely to bottom anytime soon, because you typically see a sharp decline in SHIBOR, prior to a bottoming and a reinflection higher in China's credit impulse. So, in terms of like looking at something like the KBA, the China ETF, or the FXI or something like that, those things are have been bearish, you know, or everything China ADR has been bearish, but those things that KBA at the bare minimum has popped back into neutral. I don't trust that neutral signal at all. If anything, it's telling me that there's potentially more risk emerging to the downside. So, you know, I'm not a raging China bear. I'm not a raging bear on anything in Goldilocks, but I certainly think China's an area of focus. And we haven't even talked about the regulatory risk, right? And I'll say that to say this. I think China's getting this pandemic right in a way that most Western societies are unable to. Because I think a lot of what they've done, especially with this Didi thing recently in terms of like trying to effectively nationalize Didi, I think they're realizing that the pandemic is an endemic one. And two, if the pandemic is an endemic, we're not going back to 2019 levels of you know, service sector demand and consumption. And if we don't do that, then we're probably not going to go back to 2019 levels of employment. And I think they're trying to get out in front of that transition of this sort of real societal economic transition of saying, hey, look, man, let's, you know, people are going to be really pissed if things don't get back to normal, and they're probably not going back to normal. So let's take some regulatory steps to make sure that there's more harmony and balance in society, that profits are being more evenly distributed throughout society. So I think they're taking a proactive and what ultimately might be the, you know, world beating, you know, measures. But right now, it's just not good for asset markets, right? You have people, you know, super long China in terms of all the growth that we saw there, and now they got to get out of those positions.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Darius, we got a question from Elko, who really hones in this point. Says, Darius, do you think Evergrande or other China credit risk will affect U.S. markets? Evergrande being a very large property developer in China, and I believe their bonds have traded from something like 90 cents on the dollar a few months ago to now something like 20 cents on the dollar. So that's sort of flashing red.
No, definitely not. I mean, just by definition, right? Like you say, one, China has a closed capital account, so almost nothing they do there has a real impact on from a systemic risk perspective, aside from just a major growth slowdown. And they're not going to have a major growth slowdown because Evergrande defaults or a series of other sort of high risk borrowers default in China. There's no tolerance and there's no appetite. And I learned this from Steve Roach probably 12 years ago. The good friend, good mentor, Steve Roach, 12 years ago. There's absolutely no tolerance in China for what happened, what we saw in August and September 2008, in terms of like allowing, you know, real systemic risk emanating from the financial sector. They're not going to allow that to happen. They have plenty of tools and a war chest that's north of $3 trillion to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so to answer the question, no, I don't think Evergrande's going to create a catalyst of systemic risk. If anything, it's a continuation of what China's really trying to do, which is wring the excesses out of society or out of the financial sector so that they don't have to ever worry about something like Lehman. But they're also trying to do at the top of the, you know, capital structure now. It's like, look, you guys have gotten rich with all this innovation. And Jim Bianco, excellent investor, outstanding investor, I was on Real Vision Daily Briefing on Friday, and he was saying, hey, look, man, like, they're going to scare all of the innovators out of China and into Silicon Valley. And I don't disagree with that statement. But the reality is, you know, are they going to, you know, if we're storming the Capitol and marching in every street and burning stuff in every street here in America, are they going to come to America either? Because that's where we're headed. Everything that China's probably trying to get out in front of in terms of the societal, you know, rebalancing that probably needs to take place on the other side of this, the other side of this endemic.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. Darius, I think that the hallmark of 2008 was a pension plan in Norway bought some BS product from a Wall Street bank in New York. And there you had a global contagion of financial risk where largesses in the U.S. spread and infected the world. And you're saying that China does not want that. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. But what's interesting, Darius, is that when you said that 4/5 of the credit risk is on the balance sheets of Chinese banks, and it's not on the U.S. banks, that instantly made me think of 2008. Because why is it not on the balance sheet of the U.S. banks? It's because of regulations which prevent from all this risk being on the balance sheets of U.S. banks.
They did also, I think we learned in September of 2019 and again in March of 2020 that the risk didn't go anywhere. The risk still is there. They just moved to a different place. That's what Dodd-Frank accomplished. Dodd-Frank just made it more palatable to take risk in the non-regulated sort of sectors in finance. So, you know, this is why, you know, and in my opinion, I think that's part of the reason, you know, why Jeff Snyder's been so right about, like, look, every time we have these accelerations, we wind up, you know, kind of slowing and the trend continues lower in terms of, you know, productive capacity of the economy. And the reason for that is that, look, it's hard for an economy to grow if credit creation is being done in the shadows, right? If the bulk of credit creation is being done by people who inherently don't trust each other or inherently, or, you know, economic agents who desperately need their money back, otherwise they lose their job. You know, it just makes this whole thing a lot less sort of robust. Like, you know, it also creates sort of perverse incentives to, like, be super pro-cyclical. When things are really good, here, go take an extra loan and start two car washes or two beauty salons or, you know, the next 18 Jamba Juices, whatever, you know, what happened to Jamba Juice. You know, like, that's what happens.
I believe the stock.
And then when the cycle turns, the credit spreads start to rise and the Fed's balance sheet is contracting. And it's like, no. Instead of having two Jamba Juices, we need you to sell me, to tell those Jamba Juices and give me cash. You know, like, it's such a, you know, we've created this system that's so, I'm lost for words here, but it just,
cyclical,
it's not efficient. Yeah. It's not efficient. You know, it's efficient for making money, but it's not efficient for growing an economy and really distributing wealth adequately.
Yeah, the demand to create a Jamba Juice is at its apex when really there are already too many Jamba Juices. Yeah.
Bingo, totally.
Yeah.
The willingness to finance the 18th Jamba Juice is more than the willingness to finance the first one.
Exactly. You know, the first one was cutting edge and the 18th is just like, it's exactly. Over. Yeah. Darius, just two quick events. Today, the Federal Reserve released its beige book. Its report on the economy in the U.S. for the month of August. Interestingly, I think the term Delta, as in Delta variant, appeared 32 times. Also, the ECB is scheduled to meet tomorrow, and it will announce perhaps its plans of tapers. We saw how markets reacted to the Fed's plans tomorrow. We could see how the ECB's taper will impact asset markets. Today, actually, European equities were down, I believe, over 1%. So maybe already pricing that in. Darius, I don't have time to ask you about those two things. I want to hear your thoughts, but we don't have time. But I will ask you a question from Bernardo, who asks, Darius, what's your favorite kind of sandwich?
Oh man, that is a loaded question. For those of you guys only see me sitting in this chair, I'm 6'4", 280 pounds. So I've obviously like a lot of different types of sandwiches. Being put on the spot, I'm going to have to just go bow out and say peanut butter and jelly.
You can't go wrong with that.
No, you can't. Absolutely not.
That's great. Well, Darius of 42 Macro, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everyone, to watching. If you want to see all of Darius's charts, please click on the exchange link below. Also, stay tuned for tomorrow's daily briefing, which will be Tony Greer, hosted by Maggie Lake. Awesome. Thank you.
One quick thing?
Yeah.
The new exchange is awesome. Like, you guys did a really good job with that, man. Like, it was super easy to post, super easy to interact with people. Like, it's awesome. Everybody check that out for sure.
Yeah, thank you. And I think a lot of people, they're commenting on YouTube or they're commenting on the video in realvision.com. They're sort of searching for they're yearning for a sense of community. They have their financial ideas. They want to share it with other people. They want to see what other people are saying. I think now, everything is there on the Real Vision Exchange. So I thank you, Darius, for saying that.
And it's my pleasure, man.
Watch out. All right. So thank you, everyone, and have a good night.